Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Welcome to the Sutta Study class, and today we're going to look at Sutta number 123 in the Majjhima Nikaya, Acharya Abhuta Sutta, the Wonderful and Marvelous Sutta. Please tell me if you can't hear me, if you have trouble hearing, because someone yesterday had trouble hearing in the meditation class. So this sutta recounts the miraculous birth story of the Buddha, and I've chosen it today because we're coming up to Vesak, the full moon month in May, when we celebrate the Buddha's birth, enlightenment and parinibbana. And when we come to that time of year and that time of celebration, we very often hear the stories of the Buddha's birth and of the wonderful events that happened around his conception and his birth. And we may think that those are mythological stories or somehow fairy tale like stories, because we hear that when the Buddha was born he walked and he spoke, and that we may think that those stories actually are found in some of the commentaries to the suttas, or that are found in some of the tales written by commentators about the life of the Buddha. So it's very interesting to find that those accounts actually appear in the canon itself, in both the Majjhima Nikaya and in the Digha Nikaya. And when we read these accounts, we can think that this is going outside the territory of our rational mind and understanding that Buddhism is so good because it's logical and rational and scientific, and here we're hearing something that seems to be quite outside those boundaries, and it can be quite a controversial point. People get into arguments about whether these are really factual accounts or whether they are just myths, and I'm not going to make a definitive statement on either side, except to say that the way that they're reported is according to accounts as they appear, spoken by the Buddha's own words, own lips. And also one of the points in this sutta is that when we're looking at the wonderful and marvellous things about the Buddha, spoken in praise of him by his disciples, at the end of this sutta he talks about something which is equally as wonderful and marvellous, and that is his level of practice. And this is a thing which brings us back full circle to the attainments that we can aspire to realize for ourselves through practicing this path. So although the beginning of the sutta is about these wonderful and marvelous qualities of the Tathagata, the enlightened one, it ends with an aspect of practice. And before we go on to the sutta itself, I just like to draw your attention to some words in the introduction of the Majjhima Nikaya, by written by Bhikkhu Bodhi on page 24 when he is talking about the Buddha and the Buddha in the Majjhima Nikaya. Just on page 22, I'll just read one sentence. The Buddha in the Majjhima Nikaya, biographical information for its own sake, was never an overriding concern of the redactors of the Pali Canon, and thus the data the Majjhima provides on the life of the Buddha is scanty and uncoordinated, included principally because of the light it sheds on the Buddha as the ideal exemplar of the spiritual quest and the fully qualified teacher. So if we think in those terms about the Buddha as the ideal exemplar of the spiritual quest and as the fully qualified teacher, then on page 24, I'll just continue to read the introduction by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Although the canon is precise and reliable in affording such details of the Buddha's life, for the early Buddhist community, interest focuses upon the Buddha not so much in his concrete historical particularity as in his archetypal significance. Whereas outsiders might view him merely as one among many of the spiritual teachers of the day, and they would call him the recluse Gotama, to his disciples he is, quote, he is vision, he is knowledge, he is the Dharma, he is the Holy One, the giver of the deathless, the Lord of the Dharma, the Tathagata. That's a quote from Sutta number 18. The last term, the Tathagata, is the epithet the Buddha uses most often when referring to himself, and it underscores his significance as the great arrival who brings to fulfillment a cosmic repetitive pattern of events. The Pali commentators explain the word as meaning thus come, tata agata, and thus gone, tata gata. That is, the one who comes into our midst bearing the message of deathlessness to which he has gone by his own practice of the path. As the Tathagata, he possesses the 10 powers of knowledge and the 4 infirmities, thus enabling him to roar his lion's roar, as he did in Majjhima 12. He is not merely a wise sage or a benevolent moralist, but the latest in the line of fully enlightened ones, each of whom arises singly in an age of spiritual darkness, discovers the deepest truths about the nature of existence, and establishes a dispensation or sasana through which the path to deliverance again becomes accessible to the world. Even those of his disciples who have attained unsurpassable vision, practice, and deliverance still honour and venerate the Tathagata as one who enlightened himself teaches others for the sake of their enlightenment, as in Majjhima 35. Looking back at him following his demise, the first generation of monks could say, the Blessed One was the arouser of the unarisen path, the producer of the unproduced path, the declarer of the undeclared path. He was the knower of the path, the finder of the path, the one skilled in the path, which is followed by and attained to afterwards by his disciples, as his disciples say in Majjhima Sutta 108. So bearing in mind this role of the Buddha, or the way that he's seen by his disciples as someone who's not just a great teacher, but one who is coming in to, he's the latest in the line of fully enlightened ones each of whom arises singly in an age of spiritual darkness, discovers the deepest truths about the nature of existence and establishes a dispensation through which the path to deliverance again becomes accessible to the world. So bearing that in mind, this definition of the Tathagata thus gone through his own wisdom, through his own delight and enlightenment. So if you bear that in mind, then it throws some light on this sutta, the wonderful and marvellous sutta. And we'll just start to read. And if you have any questions as we go through, please stop me. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. Now a number of bhikkhus were sitting in the assembly hall where they had met together on returning from their alms round after their meal. And when this discussion arose among them, "It is wonderful, friends, it is marvellous. How mighty and powerful is the Tathagata. For he is able to know about the Buddhas of the past, who attained to final nibbana, cut the tangle of proliferation, broke the cycle, ended the round, and surmounted all suffering. That for those blessed ones, their birth was thus, their names were thus, their clans were thus, their virtue was thus, their state of concentration was thus, their wisdom was thus, their abiding in attainments was thus, and their deliverance was thus." So they're saying how marvellous the Buddha is, that he is able to know the previous Buddhas and know all about them. And in the Digha Nikaya 14 and Digha Nikaya 32, the seven most recent Buddhas, including our Buddha, are mentioned, and they are Vipassin, Sikin, Vesabhu, Kakusanda, Konagama, Kasapa, and Gotama. And the names of these seven previous Buddhas, including the Buddha of this dispensation, their names are often included in chants which are for protection. So the Buddha knew the names of those previous Buddhas and knew all about their attainments and their virtues and their wisdom. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda told the bhikkhus, "Friends, Tathagatas are wonderful and have wonderful qualities. Tathagatas are marvellous and have marvellous qualities." However, their discussion was interrupted, for the Blessed One rose from meditation when it was evening, went to the assembly hall and sat down on a seat made ready. When he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, what discussion are you sitting together here and now, and what was your discussion that was interrupted?" "Here, Venerable Sir, we were sitting in the assembly hall where we had met together on returning from our alms round after our meal, when this discussion arose amongst us. It is wonderful, friends, it is marvellous. Their deliverance was thus," that is the Buddha knowing about the previous Buddhas. "When this was said, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Ananda said to us, 'Friends, Tathagatas are wonderful, have wonderful qualities. Tathagatas are marvellous and have marvellous qualities.' This was our discussion, Venerable Sir, that was interrupted when the Blessed One arrived." Then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Ananda, "That being so, Ananda, explain more fully the Tathagata's wonderful and marvellous qualities." So now we have Venerable Ananda speaking. "I heard and learned this, Venerable Sir, from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and fully aware, Ananda, the Bodhisattva appeared in the Trisutta heaven." That mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva appeared in the Trisutta heaven. This I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. I'm just looking at the notes. this refers to the Bodhisattva's rebirth in the true seat of heaven, which followed his preceding human existence as Vesantara and preceded his birth in the human world as Siddhartha Gautama. So Vesantara is the story that's given as one of the Buddha's previous births, in which he perfected generosity. And then from that birth he was reborn in the two-seater heaven, mindfully and fully aware. And it was from the two-seater heaven that he was reborn as Siddhartha Gautama. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva remained in the two-seater heaven. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. For the whole of his lifespan, the Bodhisattva remained in the two-seater heaven. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. So the lifespan in the two-seater heavenly realm is far surpasses the human lifespan. So it'll be life a span of thousands of years.
In this sense, is it advocating Vesantara's story, even though it was the first four onwards? So does it validate, if not advocate, the truth of Vesantara's story?
Does it validate it? I suppose only in the sense that you have faith that it's true. And the previous birth stories of the Buddha are all meant to indicate his progression as he continued to develop his virtuous qualities until he was completing virtue in order to be ready to take birth for the realization of enlightenment. So whether you say it validates that or not, I'm not sure whether you could say that. If you only, it really only validates it if you have faith that it's an accurate rendering.
From Buddhist perspective, maybe I just want to verify that some Western scholars seem to think that these are just stories.
Yes.
And just want to know whether what the bhikkhus and bhikkhuni think of that Jataka tales as
accurate.
Accurate, yes.
Yes. Well, I can't talk for bhikkhus and bhikkhunis or nuns and monks generally, but I can only say yes, I think that it's accurate. I these are part of the canon, so I accept them. Yes. So, and there is a controversy because the Buddha was never born as a female in any of those stories, although he took birth as an animal. And so there are all sorts of ways in which you can approach those tales and ask whether they're accurate and fully representative. And we have to remember that a lot of the Jataka tales and many other things haven't been translated into English, so we don't have a full rendering of all that's available. So even in things that we share in common with the Chinese canon also, we don't have all of those in English, so we can't say that we've looked at everything that's there. I think that's the way that Kuan Yin is portrayed in some traditions, yes.
You start off by hearing that bhikkhus returned from alms, and it's before
I think that works out because they'd have taken their food and they'd gathered to talk, and then the Buddha comes from his meditation in the evening. It seems to all flow. The Buddha probably would have gone on arms round in the morning too, and then retired for meditation, and then came afterwards to where the bhikkhus had gathered. That seems to flow. Yes. So after they went on arms round, and they'd had their food, then they gathered together. So that may have been through the day, or they may have also, usually after going on arms round, people go into the forest to meditate, and then come together. So they may have just been staying there together throughout the day. Sometimes, if you realise that many of the monks and nuns would have been living in quite separate places, and they didn't always get the opportunity to come together with other monastics. So if they had come together in a certain place, they might take the opportunity to meet together and discuss Dharma instead of separating during the day. So this might be one of the occasions. So we're up to verse 6. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva passed away from the two-seater heaven and descended into his mother's womb. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva passed away from the two-seater heaven and descended into his mother's womb, then a great immeasurable light, surpassing the splendour of the gods, appeared in the world, with its gods, its maras and its brahmas, in this generation with its recluses and brahmins, with its princes and people, and its people. That is a stock phrase for describing the universe as we know it, all of those beings who are in it, the part that we can see and that we share, other human beings, and also the heavenly realms. And even in those abysmal world interspaces of vacancy, gloom and utter darkness, where the moon and the sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail, there too a great immeasurable light, surpassing the splendour of the gods, appeared. And the beings there perceived each other by the light. So other beings indeed have appeared here. And this 10,000-fold world system shook and quaked and trembled, and there too a great immeasurable light, surpassing the splendour of the gods, appeared. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. And this, the great space of darkness between the worlds, according to the commentary, between every three world systems there is an interspace measuring 8,000 yojanas. It is like the space between three cartwheels or alms bowls touching one another. So that relatively those world systems are very close together, but in terms that are measurable by us, they are very widely separated. The beings who live there have taken rebirth there because of committing some heavy, terrible offence against their parents, or righteous recluses and Brahmins, or because of some habitual evil deed like killing animals. So the beings who live in those dark, gloomy spaces are reborn there in isolation, basically. They've gone to a very isolated place, and it's only when that light appears that they realise that they're not alone. There are other beings also present in that birth. So verse 8, I heard... I would say it's a visible light.
So, does it mean that 2,500 years ago there was such a bright light appeared in the
universe? That's what it seems to be saying. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, four young deities came to guard him at the four quarters, so that no humans or non-humans or anyone at all could harm the Bodhisattva or his mother. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. So the commentary says, the four deities were the four great kings, the presiding deities of the heaven of the four great kings. And that's the heavenly realm, which is said to be closest to the human realm. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she became intrinsically virtuous, refraining from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct in sensual pleasures, from false speech, and from wines, liquors, and intoxicants, which are the basis of negligence. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. So she became intrinsically virtuous, keeping the five precepts. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, no sensual thought arose in her concerning men, and she was inaccessible to any man having a lustful mind. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she obtained the five cords of sensual pleasure, and furnished and endowed with them, she enjoyed herself with them. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. So that means that she was able to have whatever she wanted in terms of things, pleasant things to see, only seeing pleasant things, only hearing pleasant things, only tasting pleasant things, smelling pleasant things, and feeling pleasant touches, having what she wanted. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, no kind of affliction arose in her. She was blissful and free from bodily fatigue. She saw the Bodhisattva within her womb with all his limbs, lacking no faculty. Suppose a blue, yellow, red, white, or brown thread was strung through a fine beryl gem of purest water, eight-faceted, well-cut, and a man with good sight were to take in his hand and view it thus. This is a fine beryl gem of purest water, eight-faceted, clear, well-cut, and through it is strung a blue, yellow, red, white, or brown thread. So too, when the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she saw the Bodhisattva within her womb with all his limbs, lacking no faculty. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. 7 days after the birth of the Bodhisattva, his mother died and reappeared in the two-seater heaven. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. The commentary says, this happened not through a defect in the birth, but through the expiration of her lifespan. For the place in the womb occupied by the Bodhisattva, like the inner chamber of a chaitya, is not to be used by others. So we say she's fulfilled her karma or her destiny to be the mother of the Bodhisattva, and that she died 7 days after his birth. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Other women give birth after carrying the child in the womb for 9 or 10 months, but not so the Bodhisattva's mother. The Bodhisattva's mother gave birth after carrying him in her womb for exactly 10 months. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Other women give birth seated or lying down, but not so the Bodhisattva's mother. The Bodhisattva's mother gave birth to him standing up. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, first gods received him, then human beings. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, he did not touch the earth. The four young gods received him and set him before his mother, saying, "Rejoice, O Queen, a son of great power has been born to you." This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, he came forth unsullied, unsmeared by water or humours or blood or any kind of impurity, clean and unsullied. Suppose there were a gem placed on khasi cloth, then the gem would not smear the cloth or the cloth the gem. Why is that? Because of the purity of both. So too when the Bodhisattva came forth, he was clean and unsullied. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, two jets of water appeared to pour from the sky, one cool and one warm, for bathing the Bodhisattva and his mother. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. As soon as the Bodhisattva was born, he stood firmly with his feet on the ground. Then he took 7 steps north, and with a white parasol held over him, he surveyed each quarter and uttered the words of the leader of the herd. "I am the highest in the world. I am the best in the world. I am the foremost in the world. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being for me." This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. The commentary explains. The commentary explains each aspect of this event as a foretoken of the Buddha's later attainments. Thus standing with his feet firmly on the ground was the foretoken of his attaining the four bases of spiritual power. His feet, pada, become iddhipada. His facing the spiritual power. His facing the north of his going above and beyond the multitude. His 7 steps of his acquiring the 7 enlightenment factors. The white parasol of his acquiring the parasol of deliverance. His surveying the quarters of his acquiring the unobstructed knowledge of omniscience. His uttering the words of the leader of the herd, of his setting in motion the irreversible wheel of Dharma. His statement, "This is my last birth," of his passing away into the Nirvana element with no residue remaining of the factors of existence. So these are the commentarial explanations.
Another question. Was there any where in the sutras where Buddha claimed omniscience?
There's a question about omniscience in one of the sutras, and the Buddha makes the distinction that he can know anything but not know everything all at once. That omniscience, as far as the Buddha describes it, is only by putting his mind to something that he is able to know it, but not to know everything at once in the one moment of time that one has to put. So the Buddha can know anything but has to put his mind to it.
So it's in a sense sequentially rather than simultaneously.
Yes, yes. That's the way he describes it. And if we get chance, I want to finish with just a passage from another sutta, which is the greater sutta on the lion's roar, in which the Buddha talks about the qualities as the Tathagata that he had in terms of his mental abilities. And he talks in that about how he, what he taught or what he, and what he knows is there's a vast difference, so that we only know from him in his teaching a very small amount of what he actually knew through his own wisdom. So verse 20, when the Buddha takes the step, the seven steps, and then makes the statement, "This is my last birth. There is no renewal of being for me," indicates that part of his mindfully passing away from the sea to heaven and mindfully passing into his mother's womb, that there was already the understanding that he would be able to attain enlightenment in his last birth. He still didn't have the requisite knowledge, but he knew that he had the potential to become a fully enlightened being. The parasol was from the gods. And many of these symbols you will see in other traditions of Buddhism too, in Tibetan Buddhism, for example. And you see the steps, taking steps on lotuses and all that sort of thing. So I think it's interesting just to be aware of the fact that these things actually appear in the Pali Canon, when most of the descriptions of the Buddha and his powers seek to emphasize just his human nature and the fact that he was able to develop his mental powers, and that we're able to do the same because he was a human being as we are a human being. But here we see a sutta that's actually talking about all of these miraculous things. Rather than as a fate.
Rather than as a predetermined thing, no matter what I do or what
I will
be enlightened.
No, but the direction of his previous births had been such to propel the mind to a state of purity already. So there would be very little chance of him doing anything that was reckless or heedless or harmful. So that sense of would be that clarity of mind, purity of mind would be there, but certainly only in terms of cause and effect to accomplish this path. But obviously he didn't have a full understanding of what was needed to accomplish the path, because he undertook the austerities for 6 years and thought that would be the way that he could accomplish his enlightenment. So there was some sense in which his understanding wasn't fully developed at that statement.
So does it suggest that when Buddhism was in heaven throughout his life, and he was moving mindful?
Yes. And one of the qualities of the of rebirth in a heavenly realm is that you can remember your past births. You can remember where you were born last. So if he was in the Tusita realm, he would have been aware of the life prior to his birth there. And so presumably that would have been in accordance with his aspiration to be enlightened. So there would have been that recognition that through countless lifetimes I've been practicing for this, and now I've come to the point where I've accomplished what needs to be accomplished to be able to realize my aspiration. Yes. And so that's what his statement is in being born, but to be able to perfect it in the lifetime as Siddhartha Gautama, he still had to do the work to perfect it. So we don't, for example, you know, the Buddha left the palace. He didn't say, well, I can perfect it by staying in the palace and just being a prince and living that sort of life. He made conscious choices because of the desire to understand things deeply. So there were still things that he had to do in order to accomplish the goal. Yes. So this is one of the issues. There are points of controversy about if the Buddha could remember his past lives with previous Buddhas. Did he have some understanding already about enlightenment when he came into his last birth? Or did he really have to start from scratch in that last birth to develop the path? So there are some suttas in which, as the Buddha, he recalls having lived under a previous Buddha. This was after his enlightenment as Siddhartha Gautama. But when the Buddha attained enlightenment on the night of his enlightenment, then he remembered his past births. He remembered his many, many, many past lives. But the assumption is that once he was born in his final birth and growing up, he could not remember those. That came later with his enlightenment. Yes. Yes, he talked about practicing under Kasapa. So we're up to verse 21. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, then a great immeasurable light, surpassing the splendour of the gods, appeared in the world with its gods, its Maras and its Brahmas, in this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, with its princes and its people, and even in those abysmal world interspaces of vacancy, gloom and utter darkness, where the moon and the sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail. There too a great immeasurable light, surpassing the splendour of the gods, appeared, and the beings born there perceived each other by that light. So other beings indeed have appeared here. And this 10,000 world system shook and quaked and trembled, and there too a great immeasurable light, surpassing the splendour of the gods, appeared. That when the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, then a great immeasurable light, surpassing the splendour of the gods, appeared. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. So when he was moved from Tusita heaven down to earth, and also when he was born, there was this light and this shaking. And if I remember correctly, that also appeared with his enlightenment, and also when he relinquished the life force and announced that he was going to pass away in 3 months' time. So there were certain times when that great light or that earthquake happens in the course of the Buddha's lifetime. I can't quite remember all of the times, but it's mentioned again as one of the amazing things that happens. So the question is, does this seem that anyone with eyes around the earth, around the whole earth, would be able to see that light? I assume that to be true. That is. Not the blind, I wouldn't think. But earthquake, that people would feel that the earth quake or tremble. So, verse 22, that being so, Ananda, remember this too as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Tathagata. So this is the Buddha himself now adding on. He's heard about all these wonderful and marvellous things to do with his conception and with his birth, and these are all things that Venerable Ananda, his attendant, is repeating that he's heard from the Buddha's own lips as part of the Buddha's life story. But now the Buddha is adding something on. That being so, Ananda, remember this too as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Tathagata. Hear, Ananda, for the Tathagata, feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, and as they disappear. Perceptions are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, and as they disappear. Remember this too, Ananda, as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Tathagata. And so the commentary says, this statement seems to be the Buddha's way of calling attention to the quality he regarded as the true wonder and marvel. That is, that he's fully mindful. And if we are looking at the way perceptions, feelings and thoughts, sankharas, these are aspects of the mind, and in terms of the foundations of mindfulness, these are the both the vedanupassana, so the feeling, and then the cittanupassana is also in there in terms of the quality of the mind, and then the dhammanupassana is what arises in the mind, so thoughts that arise in the mind that we can know as an object of awareness. So the Buddha is saying that he is fully mindful, and this is a truly wonderful and marvellous quality. Venerable Sir, since for the Blessed One feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, and as they disappear, perceptions are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Blessed One. That is what the Venerable Ananda said, the teacher approved. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Ananda's words. Is perfect mindfulness shared by all of his arahat disciples? Now, you have got me there. I would say that there are grades of mindfulness in the arahat disciples, because there is occasion where arahat disciples act out of habit and are not fully aware of what they're doing. So, and then there were other arahat disciples who were praised for their consummate practice of the four foundations of mindfulness and their perfection of mindfulness. So I would say that there would be grades of mindfulness even amongst the fully enlightened ones. But I stand to be corrected if anyone knows differently. Um, the question is, most of the direct relations of the Buddha attained enlightenment because they were able to practice under the Buddha. So many of his family members. What about his mother? We heard the traditional story is that the Buddha went to give teachings to his mother into the heavenly realm, and I actually thought that she was reborn in the Tathagatimsa heaven and that he went there because he's supposed to have gone to the Tathagatimsa heaven to teach the Abhidharma to his mother and to have spent the rainy season there during one of the rains retreats to pass on the teaching to his mother. And I'm not aware that she became fully enlightened, but I stand to be corrected. She may still be in the Tathagatimsa heaven, reborn as a Deva there. Ah, that may be it, see. I don't know. Yes, so the question and the doubt is expressed that the Buddha's mother was born in the Tusita heaven and she went down to the Tathagatimsa heaven when the Buddha went to teach the Abhidharma. We know from history, historical investigation of the Abhidharma, that it was a later addition. It wasn't actually existing during the time of the Buddha. So then there is a doubt about the authenticity of the teaching being given in the heavenly realm during the Buddha's own lifetime and then appearing through the elaboration by Venerable Sariputta. So, yes, that's one of those, I haven't got an answer to that, but there's a doubt there. So I guess I'm chose this sort of particularly so that there is a doubt in people's minds sometimes about how accurate or real or authentic these particular stories may be. And the Buddha encouraged us not to believe things that we don't find believable or that we don't know as true from our own experience. And so it's quite all right not to have a full 100% belief about these things, but I think also the fact that the sutra ends by pointing to the Buddha's perfection of mindfulness, and that is one of the qualities that we strive to perfect as a path to, as part of the path to enlightenment, that reminds us that these are the things that we can actually practice for ourselves and attain for ourselves and know for ourselves the benefits that they bring. So even if we have some doubts about certain aspects of the birth story or whatever, we don't have to doubt the practical teachings and the practical efficacy of the Buddhist teachings. So one of the reasons for these sutta studies is not necessarily to answer all the questions, but to allow things to be aired. And I certainly don't have all the answers. Yes, the point is made that if the Buddha has these qualities, it's a way of rousing faith to the people around him. And this is one of the things which generally the Buddha didn't approve of, and that was the use of psychic powers, for example, to rouse faith in potential disciples. Although we have this story that when he went to Kapilavastu to visit his family after his enlightenment, and the Sakyans were very proud, and they couldn't believe, or they wouldn't easily be convinced that he was now fully enlightened, that he performed the twin miracle of having fire and water both coming from his body, so mastery over the fire element and mastery over the water element simultaneously. And that was a miracle which left them awestruck and showed them that he did have some amazing powers. So just because we can't personally do any of these things doesn't mean that the Buddha couldn't do them and didn't have mastery over the elements of his body, the fire element and the water element, which are two of the four elements that make up all material existence. So only on certain occasions he would engage in the display of his full powers, not usually just to convince people that they should have faith in him. So I'd just like to finish off by reading the section out of the Greatest Discourse on the Lion's Roar. This is sutra number 12 in the Majjhima Nikaya and page 177. And I just read this because it again just shows the fullness of the Buddha's powers or knowledge or wisdom, and that we don't know all of things that he was capable of or that he knew. And this is a sutta in which the Buddha is talking about the powers of the Tathagata and in relation to a disciple who had been a monk and who disrobed and was dissatisfied with the Buddha's teaching, and so he was talking in a disparaging way about the Buddha, and the Buddha was saying, well, it's understandable that this person will speak like that and will never be able to speak really in praise of the things that are worthy of praise in the Buddha or the Tathagata because he hasn't developed that knowledge or wisdom. So in the final part he says to Venerable Sariputta, this is the Buddha speaking, Sariputta, there are certain recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. As long as this good man is still young, a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessings of youth in the prime of life, so long as he is perfect, so long is he perfect in his lucid wisdom. But when this good man is old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, and come to the last stage, being 80, 90, or 100 years old, then the lucidity of his wisdom is lost. But it should not be regarded so. I am now old, aged, burdened in years, advanced in life, and come to the last stage. My years have turned 80. Now suppose that I had 4 disciples with 100 years lifespan, perfect in mindfulness, retentiveness, memory, and lucidity of wisdom. Just as a skilled archer, trained, practiced, and tested, could easily shoot a light arrow across the shadow of a palm tree, suppose that they were even to that extent perfect in mindfulness, retentiveness, memory, and lucidity of wisdom. Suppose that they continuously asked me about the 4 foundations of mindfulness, and that I answered them when asked, and that they remembered each answer of mine and never asked a subsidiary question, or paused except to eat, drink, consume food, taste, urinate, defecate, and rest in order to remove sleepiness and tiredness. Still, the Tathagata's exposition of the Dharma, his explanations of factors of the Dharma, and his replies to questions would not yet come to an end. But meanwhile, those four disciples of mine, with their 100 years lifespan, would have died, and at the end of those would have died at the end of those 100 years. Sariputta, even if you have to carry me about on a bed, still there will be no change in the lucidity of the Tathagata's wisdom. Rightly speaking, were it to be said of anyone, a being not subject to delusion has appeared in the world for the welfare and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the good welfare and happiness of gods and humans. It is of me indeed that, rightly speaking, this should be said. So basically the Buddha is saying that he knows far more than he's taught, and far more than could ever be asked of him. And so, especially when he refers to the four foundations of mindfulness and the practice of mindfulness being central to the realization of the path and the attainment of enlightenment, that there is far more that he is aware of than was taught to his disciples. So this statement, this last statement, is made at the end of his life, when he's aged and burdened with years. So I guess my point in reading that was to juxtapose the beginning of his life and the end of his life, that although his birth has lots of miraculous things about it, which may or may not incline the mind to faith, his teaching and his realization was undimmed by the years that he lived, and at the end of his life he was still there was still much that he had that he hadn't passed on or hadn't been able to pass on to his disciples. So this is the end of the sutta teaching. Is there any, are there any further questions?
So there's a little question I thought you just put out there, that, you know, it's really saying that in our age and Alzheimer's was not an option for
them. Not to the Buddha, no. Alzheimer's was not an option for them. And if you make progress in this direction, then it's a bulwark against dementia or Alzheimer's. That seems to be the case in seeing the effects of training the mind in studies that they've done on the brains of nuns who've passed away, Catholic nuns who've allowed their brains to be examined after their death, that they found evidence of deterioration that would normally bring symptoms of Alzheimer's or dementia, and yet those symptoms haven't been obvious in their behaviour and the way that they interact with people. So there seems to be some evidence that the mind can be trained over a long period and can counter the effects of the deterioration of the brain. And sometimes, from the my reading of the study, that the symptoms aren't seen until after they die, and then they do the post-mortem, and this community of nuns in America has been studied over many years now, and because it's a very stable community and the nuns are in there for life, and many of them die in their late 80s or 90s or 100, and so they've been, the thing that seems to be, have a very effect on the quality of their mind at the time of their death is that throughout the course of their life they keep a spiritual diary which no one has access to except their confessor, but they've given permission for that diary to be read by the researchers after their death. And the correlation seems to be between those who have active mentally and are able to explore their emotions and their mental, their relationship to their spiritual life and to cultivate those qualities. Those who show evidence of that from throughout their life through this, from their spiritual diary, have been found to not exhibit the same degree of mental deterioration that one would expect to see from the quality of their brain. So there seems to be some evidence that cultivation does actually make one capable of refraining from acting on Alzheimer's. Yeah. I'm not sure quite how it works, but I imagine that's how it works.
Diagnosis cannot be certain until the postmortem is done.
Yes.
A lot of neurologists do not want to enter into diagnosing before death about the dementia, dementia, Alzheimer's disease, because of liability.
Uh-huh.
This is a fact.
Yeah. Mm.
So, I've seen many, at least I've met 2 months, 3 months.
Yes. Yes.
In fact, when Yana Punika, who I met in 94 before his death, he was amazing.
Yes.
He was so sharp. And people, he mentioned it to people, if this man, this, that, and the other, and one after another, he just said it.
Yes. Yes.
It was amazing.
Yes.
That's really my experience.
Yes. So even though the physical body was deteriorating very much and there was still this mental clarity there. So I just leave these things for you to ponder, and I'd just like to share the merits that we've made by looking into the Dharma and exploring wonderful teaching. So when I chant, if you know the chant, please chant along with me. And when I say, may the merits made by me, I'm speaking for everyone here. May the merits made by me, now or at some other time, be shared among all beings here, infinite, immeasurable, by rejoicing in this cause, this gift of merits given by me. May beings all forever live a happy life, be free from hate, and may they find the path secure, and their good wishes all succeed. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.